The name of the message this morning I've titled, When God Rests Under the Tree. The text is taken from Genesis chapter 18. And you can turn there, you can look at the screen because we have the words here. It says, Now the Lord appeared to him by the oaks of Mamre, while he was sitting at the tent door in the heat of the day. When he lifted up his eyes and looked, behold, three men were standing opposite him. And when he saw them, he ran from the tent door to meet them and bowed himself to the earth and said, My Lord, if now I found favor in your sight, please do not pass your servant by. Please let a little water be brought and wash your feet and rest yourselves under the tree. And I will bring a piece of bread that you may refresh yourselves. And after that, you may go on since you have visited your servant. And they said, So do as you have said. Now, this is one of those pre-appearances, a theophany, an appearance of God in the Old Testament, sometimes a Christophany, an Old Testament appearance of Christ. And he recognizes this. It says, Now the Lord, and the word Lord there in the Hebrew is the word Jehovah. And it says that he appeared to him while he was sitting at the tent door in the heat of the day. What you need to realize here is, let's back up just a little bit. And talk about what's happened before he, how did he get to Mamre? How did he get here in this place, sitting under this oak tree in the desert in the heat of the day? What happened? What transpired? If you go all the way back to Genesis 13 and 18, you'll see that Mamre was a place of separation. And more accurately, it was a separation from a carnal following. This goes all the way back to the time when Lot was with him. And their herds and flocks and families had gotten so large that they were just bumping into each other all the time. They decided to split up and go their separate ways. And Abraham gave Lot first choice. He said, you know, pick. And he looked towards the fertile field of the Jordan Valley, which is that area that's now known as the Dead Sea. But that was before it was scorched in a hurricane of fire. The region around the five cities of Sodom, Gomorrah, Admah, Zeboim, and Zoar. And of those five, four of them were destroyed. Sodom and Gomorrah are the ones that are most often mentioned and they're most prominent, but there were actually five cities that were destined for judgment. Four of them, Admah, Zeboim, Sodom, and Gomorrah, were destroyed in the hurricane of fire. Zoar was spared because this was where Lot had fled to when he left the city of Sodom and Gomorrah. And what's kind of interesting about that to me is that the word Zoar means little city. The word Zoar means little. His name was Lot, but he ended up with little. And at Zoar, eventually, he will have an incestuous relationship in a drunken stupor with his own daughters and father two nations. And from him, that which opposed God's people will be born. But there was this strife and the lifting of the eyes, and Lot chose Jordan Valley, which at that time was a fertile garden. In fact, he said, you can read in Genesis 13 and 18, he said, and it says this was before Sodom and Gomorrah were destroyed, he says it was like the garden of God. It was a beautiful and fertile place. It was the choice place. And what's interesting about that is that it says Lot lifted up his eyes and he saw the region known as Sodom and Gomorrah, the Jordan Valley. He lifted up his eyes, but not quite high enough, because Lot was on a journey with Abraham to inherit the blessings and promises of Abraham. But he had now is in a place of forfeiting those because he had not learned to lift up his eyes high enough. He could see grass and commerce and prosperity and blessing and abundance and fruitfulness, but he couldn't see God. And today there is perhaps many who are caught in the same trap. Look no higher than the place of material blessing. In fact, there are even some who their whole motive for God and church at all is, you know, how can I be blessed? It's all about how can I bless? How can I get what I want? How can I use God to be rich, wealthy, healthy, successful? And there's a whole company of prophets who are more than willing to espouse this kind of teaching, which is far from the gospel. And so it's a kind of a settling for what is good while forfeiting what is best. And sometimes good can be the enemy of the best. And so they split up, and you'll notice this. Abraham will not follow after Lot's low vision. He will not forfeit the promise. He will not be carried away into this place. And then you go over into chapter 14. This is what's happened before he gets there and what brings him to this place and time. And it's important to understand, okay? What you want to see is you go through chapter 14. I don't have time to read all of this. It would take a very long time. But in chapter 14, you find what I call foreign influence. An influence that is foreign to the purposes and the promise and the calling of God. Influence that is foreign to the kingdom of God, the authority and rule of His kingdom. A foreign influence. There is a domination of foreign influence that has to be walked away from, that has to be broken. That if it dominates Abraham's life, he will forfeit the place of blessing and promise that God has for him. Be very careful, because there are a lot of people who are caught under the domination, some people even the control, of influences that are foreign to the purposes of God and the calling of His kingdom and the rule of His kingdom in our lives. There were four of these. Let me mention them just very briefly. The first king was over an area called Arioch, and he was the servant of the moon god. It was a god of supposedly of wisdom and knowledge. And what's interesting about this is that the moon god was the principal deity of a city in the Chaldees called Ur. Now that should ring a bell with you, because if you're familiar with the Old Testament story of Abraham, you know that Ur was Abraham's hometown. That God had called Abraham to leave Ur of Chaldea to walk after him. And so what you have here is this represents influences of the past. This would be an invitation. The foreign influence here would be to return to the old way, to the influences of the past, to the old and familiar of which God had called him, to return to the things that once dominated his life. There is always that temptation, foreign influence, to live in the past on our past failure or our past sins, our past hurt. The tragedies in our life. Some people, they mark themselves and their identities by the tragedies of their life. I'm the woman who got divorced. I'm the man who had cancer. And those things become, they almost take on an identity and they begin to identify themselves that way. Or it may simply be old ways of thinking or patterns for living and patterns of thinking. And maybe it has to do with the issues of maybe dysfunction in the family. And we learn in our family systems how to relate to the rest of people. And sometimes, depending on what family system we come out of, lots of time that isn't good. It's dysfunctional. And we have a way of getting locked into that, of patterns of thinking and patterns of behavior and attitudes, sometimes which are destructive and harmful to relationships. Old patterns for living, worldly wisdom. Arioch represented the influences of the past. The second one was in a place called Elam. And Elam was a center of political power. And basically what it represents, it's talking about control and autonomy. Autonomy means self-law. It is contrary to submission to the lordship of Christ and surrender to Him. It is this need to be in control and to make things happen and to have that sense of kind of a self-domination. And then the third of these was a place called Tidal. And Tidal, the root word, means fear or to make afraid. And it speaks of fear and intimidation. This is a foreign influence that seems to undermine or seeks to undermine to undermine trust in God, destroy confidence and faith, to bring a spirit of timidity. Instead of living life boldly and on purpose with a sense of confidence, we're intimidated and kind of browbeaten and live with timidity instead of walking in quiet confidence and trust. And it plagues the soul with self-doubt and questioning, and in the process it destroys peace of mind and quiet rest in the spirit, which is also what we sang about. Peace and joy and love and rest that comes from trusting in Jesus. And the fourth of these was in a place called Shinar. You'll find these four regions located, they're mentioned in Genesis 14. If you look in Zechariah chapter 5:11, the word Shinar is used in the context of godless commercialism. In Daniel chapter 1, verse 2, the place where the temple treasures were taken to Babylon was called Shinar. And what this represents is this lusting after after prosperity, an obsession, material things, and things that would be taken, people that would be taken captive by the treasures of this world. And Jesus said, wherever your treasure is, there will your heart be also. And he said, do not lay up for yourselves treasures on this earth where the moth can eat it and the thief can steal it and the rust can corrupt it, but lay them up in heaven where it cannot be corrupted or defiled. And Peter talks about that inheritance that is reserved for us, untouchable, beyond spoil, beyond theft. And this is the idea of prosperity and materialism. You realize how many people today, you're looking right here in a synopsis of the four influences that really control and dominate the lives of so many people in our society, both outside the church and inside the church. You find all of these. People who cannot break free from the influences of the past, the bad experiences, the failures, the mistakes, the mishaps. Somebody did them wrong. They tried to do something good, and they were criticized or because they didn't do it well enough. Listen, no good deed will go unpunished. You need to remember that. And you do those kinds of things. You don't do them necessarily for the, maybe people are benefited, but ultimately you do all that you do for the glory of God. And God will always honor and remember whatever good you do in this life. They can't get beyond those types of things, whatever it may be. And some are just absolutely unwilling to really turn over the reins of their life and truly surrender to the Lordship of Jesus. And people who live because of past failures, who are just afraid to step out, afraid they're kind of intimidated and they kind of live nervously and kind of got a mousy type attitude rather than living with the boldness of a lion. And other people who are absolutely obsessed with the making and acquiring and accumulation of wealth. And it's all about prosperity and all about material things. These four kings gathered in array to go to war against those who have the same spirit of Lot. This is the same spirit of Lot. They lift their eyes, but not high enough. And their only aspiration is for happiness in this world. They don't really want to yield to the purposes of God. They move in fleshly wisdom, attempting to dominate their own world and move the kingdom of God with committees and fleshly wisdom. Their true foundation of their life is an unbridled lust for prosperity and material things. And I want you to see the difference. Mamre is a place of separation from all of that. That is a profile of Lot. And read his story carefully to see where that leads. You'll know how well this will work for you. Read the story of Lot and his family in Sodom and Gomorrah. Mamre is a place of separation from a carnal following. And that's how he gets here. He will not go that way. He walks in a path that is distinct. This is the road less taken that one of the poets wrote about. He doesn't take the line of least resistance. He is kind of pioneering and carving out his own path as God leads him. And so God comes to him, it says, in the heat of the day. Now, the heat of the day, that means noon. That's a Hebraic expression that means noon, because that is the heat of the day. And he's sitting in the door of his tent. No doubt, you have to remember, they didn't have swamp coolers and air conditioners and fans. And they're in the desert. For 40 years, they could never escape the heat. Why is he under this tree? He's looking for some kind of shade. He's in the hot part of the day. He's in the hot part of his journey with God. And he's looking for some kind of shade, some kind of rest. Notice, I want you to get this picture here. It's in the noonday, in the heat of the day. It's not in the cool early morning of sunrise when the day is beginning. Not in the cool of the late evening of sunset when the day is ending, but in the middle of the day when the sun is at its peak, the very hottest part of the day. And I can tell you that this time right here, noonday, is the most critical stage of your life. It is the most challenging part of your life. And it is certainly the most critical time for anyone who walks in a promise from God as Abraham did. I mean, you think about it. You think about just for a moment the dawn. What I mean, the dawn, it's cool still. It's cooler. Even in the summer, it will be cooler. It's peaceful, usually, because the world hasn't started its hustle and bustle yet, and a lot of people still aren't up. And so it's peaceful and it's quiet. God can break the day with less noise than you break an egg. And it's an amazing time. And it's the cool of the day. And what does it speak of? The dawn, the sunrise, speaks of the promise of a new beginning, of possibilities that are before you. There's a sense of expectation, a new day. It's something that is beginning. And when you're beginning, especially when you're beginning to walk in a promise from God, it brings us, it energizes you. There is a spring in your step. You don't live with timidity and fear. You know, there's an excitement about that because there is an expectation and there is a promise. And with that comes a passion for living in the early part of the day. And then you think about that when the sun goes down, the sun sets. They're beautiful, aren't they? Some of the most gorgeous, you know, pictures you'll ever see or witness with your own eyes are beautiful and gorgeous sunsets. And what does it speak of? While the dawn and the sunrise speaks of a beginning, the sunset speaks of a completion, of something being fulfilled, of something being accomplished. And with that comes a deep sense of inner satisfaction. You know, like Paul when he said, I have kept the faith, I have finished my course, I've fought a good fight. He said that at the sunrise, at the conclusion of his life. Dawn is where the promise is first spoken. Dusk is where it's fulfilled. Noonday, that's when you're living in between promise and fulfillment. And it will be the most stressful time of your life. Some of you today can take for a minute in your own mind and reminisce. Think about the dawn, the early part of the day when it was still cool and you had not yet encountered the hurt and wounds and the struggles that you find at noonday. When there were expectations and happiness and the thought of calamity or trouble or difficulty never entered your mind. Of a day of a job and a career, and a family and children and all of the kinds of promises and sometimes those things get derailed and tragedy comes. Or someone who has a life mission, a calling from God, and there's an excitement and an intensity and a passion with a sense of expectation, and now things have stalled and you're on hold and you're just kind of marking time, marking in place, walking in place. You remember that day back when the day was still cool, before some of the tragedy and hurt and some of the difficulties? Things that you back then would have never, ever even imagined that you would go through in your whole life. And there you are now at noonday, and the hope of finishing is so far away, and you're not sure if you've got the strength to keep going, and you're not sure if you even know the path to take. It's like, you know, there's no strength for the present, certainly not enough energy to keep running the race. And of a promise that faded, it evaporates in the heat of the day. Promise that once motivated you now mocks you because it seems out of reach. That's what noonday represents. And that's where Abraham is. He's in the most critical time of his life. Noonday is when you move days or months or even years away from the time when God first spoke to you. It's when you're still days and months or years away from the fulfillment of His promise, and His voice that was heard so clearly at sunrise seems to fade away at noonday, and the vision of a God-given destiny and purpose is lost in the blistering heat of the desert, and the hope of fulfillment evaporates in the heat of the day. Those who separate themselves from Lot's compromise to walk in a God-given promise will absolutely fight battles that carnal Christians never face. The battles that come to men and women of God that carnal Christians never fight, they don't even realize they exist because their entire religious life is spent relaxing in the shade of Sodom, and they aspire to nothing greater or nothing more. But the walk of Abraham, the walk of promise, will often lead you to desert places where you find yourself stranded in between promise and fulfillment, and the only relief is the shade of your tent. And maybe a branch of an oak tree, which really provides very little comfort. And that tent is a symbol of your sojourn, A reminder that you're still moving toward the promise, because tents are not only flimsy, they are temporary. They are there. They are made to be moved. And it reminds you that you haven't arrived at the destination. And now you're at a place where you're so tired and exhausted and drained that the many miles ahead of you seem beyond your reach. The heat of the day is not a comfortable place. It's not a pleasant time or place. It's not involved in the excitement and the bright lights of Sodom, because it is a place of struggle, perhaps a place of second guessing, of wondering if you really heard from God, wondering if God will ever fulfill His promise to you. And you'll notice it says that when they come, Abraham's eyes are down. He's sitting at the door looking down at the sand. And to raise them, to lift his eyes to see the angels before him. It's been 24 years since God first spoke to him. 24 years. And told him that the entire world would be blessed through him, that he would be a great nation, that he would inherit the land of Canaan, that he would have a son. He has experienced a measure of blessing, to be sure, but foreign kings have blessed him and they have prospered him. And Lot would have been satisfied with those lesser blessings. That would have been enough for him. But Abraham's eyes, he is called to a higher purpose. And his eyes are on a higher calling than material prosperity and temporal blessing. And beating in his heart is a promise that was spoken to him by God, a promise that is greater than merely having a good life and having fun and enjoying things. But it's a promise that carries eternal significance, and it is a promise that will outlive him, a promise that will impact every generation that follows him, including the generations that are sitting here today under the sound of my voice under that oak tree. Abraham could not have conceived of such a thing. A promise that is so vast, with implications and ramifications that are so far beyond him and his time, that Abraham cannot even imagine it, lest comprehend it. And yet, here he is, walking in a promise that was spoken years ago at sunrise. 24, 25 years later, he's at noonday and it's nowhere close to being fulfilled. When God first spoke to him, he was 75 years old. Now he is 99 years old, going on 100. And what does he have to show for his obedience? For all the weary miles he's trod through the desert, for all the sand in his shoes and the sunburn on his face. And look at the journey behind him. When he left Ur of Chaldee, he walked straight into a famine. And then he panicked and unwisely led his family into Egypt, trying to solve. He's still in control, living in fear, wanting to take control. Rather than trusting God, he goes down to Egypt and trusts in Egypt to take care of him. And in the process of that, there was a crisis there, and it was a fearful time in his life. And out of fear, he compromises his values there, and he lies about Sarah. Because she was a beautiful woman, his wife. He was afraid the Egyptians would take her, kill him and take her. So he lied and said this was his sister. He lied. He troubled his own house. And perhaps now his own wife has lost confidence in him because of his own lack of faith and his compromise. And his lack of wisdom that led him to follow his own way and look for his own solutions rather than trust in God has now put Sarah in jeopardy. And perhaps with that came a loss of respect for her husband because he lied to save his own skin. And eventually he has two wives. And now he's really got problems. I mean, those of you, if you think it's a challenge living with one spouse, try living with two. No, don't. That's not allowed anymore. No wonder he's sitting outside the tent. I got an idea. I know how he got out there. And why he's there, there's probably no peace in his house. He had to get out of the house. And then he took matters into his own hands, decided he would try to help God fulfill his promise. And so he says, okay, I'm getting old. We'll have a child by Hagar. And the birth of Ishmael only intensified the tension and stress in his family to an unbearable point. In fact, it presented a conflict so severe that today, this very hour, more than 4,000 years later, the descendants of Isaac and Ishmael are still fighting in the Middle East to this very moment. In the heat of the day, he's confronted with utter futility. He's faced with the reality that he has no power to fulfill the promise. He is almost 100 years old, and it is now physically impossible for him to father a child. His future is hopeless. It's impossible. It can't happen. I mean, look, that's hard to find a bright star in his galaxy, is it? Isn't it? I mean, he's walking in a promise, and this is how he ends up. Things have worked against him. Nothing has happened the way it was supposed to. He's exhausted from the journey, blistered from the heat, trying to find shade in the heat of the day, sitting under an oak tree. He's about ready to settle. In fact, he is ready to settle. Listen to this. He is ready to settle for something that is less than God's best. That's out of reach. I'll settle and be satisfied with something less. What are you talking about, Pastor? I'm talking about when he said to God, "Oh, that Ishmael might live before thee. You said I would have a son. Let's let Ishmael be the promise." See, listen, Abraham can hold Ishmael. He can see him. He can touch him. He can hear him. Ishmael requires nothing of faith, nothing of patience, nothing of endurance. Requires no more sojourning, no more wandering in the desert. He cannot see Isaac, much less hold him. In fact, now he can't even conceive of him. The thought of another son is nowhere in his thoughts because the possibility of such a thing is completely out of his reach. Even if he could conceive of it in his mind physically, it's impossible for him to do it. So he says to God, "Look, here's Ishmael. Can't you bless this little bit? Can't you bless this little bit that I've added to your kingdom through my own effort? And we'll call this the promise of God." This is what happens to you at noonday. This doesn't happen at sunrise. This doesn't happen at sunset. I'm talking to you about what happens, what it's like when you're at noonday sitting in the door of a tent in the hot desert looking for a little shade under an oak tree. And God says to his question, paraphrasing, "Now my intentions for you are much higher than Ishmael. The purpose that I have for you will rise much higher than anything you can produce. My purpose for you will rise higher than anything you can produce." Now let me tell you, that's a good word, because at noonday, you don't have much left. Your sack is just about empty. Your resources are drained and gone. And if it's up to you to make it happen, it isn't going to happen. No secondary blessing can compare to the promise that you have in me. I have something greater, far greater than anything your hands can produce. And you hear the anguished cry, probably the self-talk of Abraham. "I've done my best, but I've failed. I've tried to walk with you. I've made one mistake after the other. I've made one wrong turn after the other. 24 years of sojourn have been in vain, and what has it gotten me? Lot is lounging comfortably. He is the mayor of Sodom." The Bible said he sat in the gate. The gate was city hall. That's where the city officials were. He's pursuing a political career. And here am I living with snakes and scorpions in the scorching desert sun. "God, you promised to bless me, but Lord, this really doesn't look very much like blessing." And now the possibility of ever being blessed, of ever again having a joyous moment and hope again, seems completely out of reach, has evaporated like a desert mirage. "I was a fool to leave my home in Ur of Chaldee, a fool to believe that somehow God will fulfill some great purpose in me. And it's left me here under the oaks of Mamre." That's what the middle of the day looks like. That's what it's like to be in the middle of promise. When the voice you heard so clearly at sunrise, that sense of direction and purpose and passion, and meaningful, productive purpose that you had then, with no thought of heartache or trial or tragedy or disappointment or failure. It's kind of a feeling of being invincible. That voice that you heard then is silent and perhaps hasn't spoken since. And the dream you embraced in the beginning of the day at sunrise has turned into a nightmare. And sunset seems a million miles away and impossible to reach. When you have no more strength for the journey, even if you knew the right path to take. It's when your failures are greater than your successes and your mistakes have exacerbated your problem and made things worse. And when you're so aware of your failings that you wonder if you've ever gotten anything right and you're deeply distressed over your own shortcomings. The carnal crowd hanging out with Lot are never distressed over such things. Charles Finney, the great evangelist, said this, quote, "The man who is far from God feels very good about himself, quite happy with all his directions and plans and purposes in his life. The man who is getting close to God becomes increasingly aware of the depths of his own failings. He, like Isaiah, who has seen the holiness of God and is painfully aware that he's undone and unclean." End of quote. The heat of the day, when quiet trust has been eclipsed by fear and failure, and the things of the past are now dominating the present. Rather than submitting and continuing to surrender control out of fear and intimidation because you're afraid, in your own hands and assume control. And to prosperity materialism, that's a lower call. Nothing wrong with being blessed and having things. The problem is when things have you. What does Scripture say? Don't worry about what you're going to eat, what you're going to wear, where you're going to live, what kind of car you're going to drive. What did it say? Seek first the kingdom of God, His righteousness. Let all these things be added to you. Let them be an addition. Never let them be the central focus or purpose or calling of your life. They're ancillary. They're auxiliary. They are secondary. That's not what life is about. A man's life does not consist in the abundance of the things that he possesses. Because all that stuff you've got, it's headed for the landfill. That's where it's going to end up. Some people never recognize the folly of the things they spend their life to save. This is a picture of what noonday looks like. Quiet trust has been eclipsed by fear, panic. Instead of waiting on God, you take matters into your own hands, or you just simply capitulate, throw up your hands, and resolve that things will never be better, that all hope is gone, any possibilities are over, you're out of strength, out of ideas, you're finished and done, and it's kind of just, you know, how do I keep going and make it to retirement and just kind of grind out the rest of my life? The hope of sunset fades, and maybe things aren't good at home. Maybe there's struggle in relationships. Your forehead is creased with stress and tension. And you're just haunted by the nagging feeling that you've wasted your life in an absurd cause. That's what the heat of the day looks like. I just wonder, does anybody know from personal experience what it's like to be sitting in the heat of the day in front of your tent looking for a little bit of shade under an oak tree? Well, let me tell you, I hate to tell you this, but if you keep living, you probably got a destiny and a destination with an oak tree somewhere in your life. You may still be in the sunrise phase. And more than likely, at some point in your life, you will come to this place, so you might want to listen up anyway, because you may need. Now, as crazy as this will sound, but the fact of the matter is, you very well could be in the best possible position. I told you it would sound crazy. The place of no strength and the place of helpless dependence. That's the whole idea of poor in spirit. Blessed are the poor in spirit, helpless dependence. I don't have anything left. Not in my thoughts, not in my strength. I have no passion, no ideas. No, I'm gone. I'm spent. It could be the very place. Jesus said that this is the doorway into the kingdom. The poor in spirit, helpless dependence. Because it is that, listen, Jesus is all that we need, but sometimes we don't realize that until Jesus is all we have. And this is the place where you have no options and you're thrown completely and totally upon, it strips away all confidence in the flesh, in yourself. Self-sufficiency withers and melts in that sun. There's this great verse in Isaiah. It's in Isaiah 66. The prophet said, this is God speaking to the prophet, "Heaven is my throne and the earth is my footstool. Where then is a house you could build for me? And where is a place that I may rest?" I'm talking about where God rests. I'm suggesting to you that God will come and rest under your tree. This is not where he rests. He's saying, where are you going to find, what kind of, where do I sit down? Where do I come and take my rest? My hands made all these things. Thus all these things came into building. Okay, Solomon, you're going to build a temple for me? Really? Make it as beautiful, the most elaborate thing that any man has ever built. You're going to present it to me. I remind you that heaven is my throne. The universe is my throne room. The heavens are my footstool. I created everything that's coming into being. And you're going to make a house for me? Kind of like showing NASA your paper airplane. Is this the place where I rest? And all your grand and wonderful schemes that you put together? No. Look at the next verse. But to this one I will look. Him who is humble, contrite of spirit, who trembles at my word. That trembling speaks of reverence. That's what it's about. It was reverence for my word. The word contrite is from a Hebrew word that literally means crushed. In fact, it means pulverized. And very often, people who are in the heat of the day into the oaks of Mamre have been crushed. Their hopes and spirit, their life has been pulverized by whatever's gone on in their lives, by the events, some of which you never dreamed in your whole life at sunrise that you would ever have to deal with. What does he say? Where does God take his rest? In elaborate temples that we build and offer them to God? No. What catches the eye of God are those who are humbled and crushed and those who are broken. Those who still, in spite of everything that has happened around them that has broken them and crushed them, they still tremble and regard and have reverence for the word of God. A broken heart is his throne. A crushed spirit is where he rests. And what did David say when he was confronted by Nathan and he repented? And in the prayer of repentance in Psalms 51, he said, sacrifice and offering you don't delight in, else I would offer them. But the sacrifices of God are a broken spirit and a contrite heart. Oh God, these offerings you will not despise. That's a way you will not despise is a negative way of saying, God, these are offerings that are precious to you. I don't know what it is. I can't explain it. But there's something about humility and brokenness that attracts the heart of God. It stirs every compassion within him. God gives grace to the humble, but he resists the proud, and he knows the proud afar off. And what I'm suggesting to you is that while the place where you are, while it's tough and it's hard, and I struggle to find the words to describe it, for those of us who have been there, you don't really need much explanation. For those who haven't, there are probably no words that it would explain it. You have to live it to experience it. But God says, I'm not impressed with the trinkets of success. What moves the heart of God are those who are crushed in spirit, but still reverence his word. I will come to, here's what he says. I will come, I'm wrapping this up. I'm closing right now. I'll come to the one who knows. He doesn't have the resources to do it. To those who know they can never make it without me. To those who failed. To those who've given their best effort, but after 24 years are left in the dust. I will come to them in the heat of their day when they least expect it. And I will sit in the tent door with their eyes cast down, and I will come to them in their failure after they've made mistake upon mistake, and I'll come to those who are overwhelmed by futility and have lost all hope. I'll come to those in the middle of their mess when they have given up. I will come to those who are full of confusion and second guessing and have no sense of guidance. When you least expect it, I will be at your door. Oh God, stay with me. And as I was thinking about this morning, I was listening to Benice. She was talking about listening to the Bible study for a night. You know where Gideon was when the angel came and spoke to him and called him a man, a mighty man of valor? He was sitting under an oak tree. And then I said, and you know, where did God find Elijah when in depression and suicidal tendencies, he found him out in the desert. He found him under a juniper tree. And in the New Testament, where did Jesus find Zacchaeus? He was up a tree, not under one. There's a long history here of a God who will come and sit and rest under the tree. And what I want, here's what I want to close with. Here's what I want. There's not a grand climax here. The incredible thing about this story is I looked at it. I want you to understand that God comes and ministers to him. At the noonday, he comes to ministers to him. And what he says to him is you read this story, while they are communing in that fellowship, God says to him, a year from now, you'll have a baby. A year from now, he'll be 100 years old. And God says, 100 years, when you're 100, 1 year from now, pardon me, you'll have a son, you'll have a child. Is that not ludicrous? Sarah thought so. When she heard it, she laughed. And Abraham laughed. That's why they named Isaac, Isaac, because Isaac means laughter. I mean, she takes one look at Abraham. Oh boy, you know, he ain't the man he used to be. And he looks at her, you know, snoring and wrinkled in a rocking chair and thinks, no way. And yet God brought a nation from a barren womb. And I'll show you, Abraham. My promise may sleep, but it never dies. And in the heat, the vapor, and the mess you're in right now at noonday, you can't find the promise. But I assure you that it still lives. And every word I've spoken to you will be fulfilled. And 1 year from today, you'll have a baby. And let me tell you, even if you're 100 years old, if God says you're going to have a baby, you better buy some Pampers. This is almost incredible. And God ministers to him simply by his presence, just by being there. That's why it's just stay with me, be with me. An incredible sense of God's presence. But here's the turn. This is unexpected, the ending here. What does Abraham do in response? That's what God is calling us to do. What do I do when I'm under the tree at noonday looking for a little shade? Abraham says, I'll get a little water, and what little I have left, I will come and wash your feet, and I will minister to you. Isn't that incredible? God first ministers to him and comforts him. But Abraham, in response, says, Lord, let me now wash your feet. I know you're tired. I know you're exhausted. I know you're beaten up. I know you're weary. I know you don't feel like it. I know you probably don't have much left. Maybe the tank is empty and you just feel drained. But let me ask you, do you have just a little bit left? Just a little water left today to come and wash the feet of Jesus? That's figurative, of course. It's a metaphor. Do you have, with what little bit you have left, God, I'm just expended, and I don't have much left, but with what little bit I have left, let me come and minister to you. Do you? It's not a grand climax, but it's what the call, this is what the Scripture is teaching us here. You're caught in the middle and stuck between promise and fulfillment, exhausted and burnt out and beat up by the heat of the day. He will come. His promise has not been forgotten. It didn't die in the midst of our failures and mistakes and misturns and bad decisions and choices. It didn't die in the midst of heartache and calamity and tragedy and the wounds that have so damaged and caused such pain. It's still there. And God just simply says, come and bring what little you have left and minister to me and worship me.